Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, a regular feature on the ERS Respiratory Channel. My name is James Chalmers and I'm the British Lung Foundation Chair of Respiratory Research at the University of Dundee in the UK and the Deputy Chief Editor of the European Respiratory Journal. My main interests are in the areas of difficult respiratory infections and particularly bronchiectasis. And I'm going to be chairing today's podcast, which is on the topic of long-term antibiotic treatment for chronic lung disease. I'm really lucky to be joined today by two leading experts in this topic. Firstly, Professor Jodie Simpson, who's joining us from the University of Newcastle in Australia. Jodie's work has significantly advanced the understanding of asthma, its pathogenesis, and therapeutic approaches, including leading some of the key studies into the role of long-term antibiotics in this disease. And we're delighted to have her with us. And also joining us is Professor Vizia Vizica, who's Professor of Respiratory Medicine and Head of the Respiratory Division at the National Heart and Lung Institute at Imperial College in the UK. And she's also led key studies into the causes and mechanisms of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, including randomized clinical trials of long-term antibiotic therapies. Many thanks for joining us. So this is a really important clinical topic because lots of us are using more and more macrolides and other prophylactic antibiotics in our clinical practice. And there's a lot of evidence out there, different kinds of evidence. And we're really lucky that we've got two of the people who've generated a lot of that evidence today to discuss the topic. So I'm going to start by talking about that evidence and asking you, Jodie, from the perspective of asthma, first of all, to tell us a bit about what the evidence shows about the efficacy of prophylactic antibiotics.
I guess there's two main larger randomized controlled trials in asthma that support the use of macrolide antibiotics in terms of a way to reduce exacerbations. Both of them use azithromycin and have slightly different protocols. But I think the overall outcome is that in those patients who might be, you know, reaching that maximum treatment with inhaled steroids and bronchodilators, that add-on azithromycin has proven to be quite effective in reducing exacerbations in asthma. We don't know how. So I think that's one of the big questions and perhaps a big problem. But certainly I think there's good evidence in asthma, especially those who are symptomatic and more poorly controlled, where you're actually looking for add-on therapy to a point where it's now being, you know, introduced into a number of the asthma guidelines.
And in terms of the magnitude of the benefit, what sort of benefit can people expect based on the data if you're prescribing a macrolide to an asthma patient?
Certainly in our study in Australia, we saw a reduction of around 50% in exacerbations. And so these were patients who were, you know, not well controlled, taking high doses of inhaled steroids, but we were able to reduce that exacerbation rate. And it wasn't only severe exacerbations we reduced. So we looked at exacerbations across the board. And I think that's another interesting perspective. So I think that's certainly up there with what monoclonals are achieving now in the severe asthma world. So worthy of consideration.
Yeah, we'll come to that because I think in asthma, there is a really interesting question about whether you should use a macrolide or a monoclonal. The other thing in the AMAZES study that I thought was fascinating is the subgroup analysis where it seemed to work in everybody. We've got this big push towards personalized medicine, and yet macrolides seem to be a drug that works in almost everyone, which is really hard to understand.
It is really hard to understand. And believe it or not, even in 2021, we're still trying to untangle that from that study. But what we do know, I think, in that subgroup analysis, what was clear to me was it worked differently in different groups of patients. So we saw that those patients who had an eosinophilic or a T2 high background, they tended to have the reductions in those severe exacerbations where you know, the requirement for oral steroids and things like that. Whereas in the patients who didn't have T2 high asthma, who had what we would call non-eosinophilic asthma, we saw changes there in things like moderate exacerbations, so antibiotic requirements and things like that. So I guess my personal view is that it works differently in those two groups of patients, but it works equally. So you get a positive outcome, but the mechanisms, I think, are different, and we're yet to unravel those completely.
Yeah, I like the idea that we can't figure out the mechanism because it's working differently in different people. So there's multiple mechanisms, which is...
Yeah, that goes towards the personalized medicine.
Vizier, coming to you to talk about COPD, I guess there's some similarities and some differences in the data in COPD.
Well, I think the asthma doctors are rather lucky, aren't they? They get these big changes in exacerbation rate and wonder why we can only do 20-25%, which is the seems to be, if you study COPD, the type of reduction in exacerbation rate that you actually see. But what I think macrolides do is actually reduce the severity of the event. And this is very important. In fact, in one of the studies that we did, we showed reduction in the lengths of an exacerbation. So what is the evidence in COPD? There have been a few trials. Indeed, we did the first one with erythromycin. We couldn't get azithromycin at the time because it was targeted for the macro study, actually. So we did low dose erythromycin and we saw a benefit, and we saw it particularly in frequent exacerbators at the time. And I will talk a bit about smoking and the evidence for smokers versus non-smokers, because this is very important. This was followed by the large macro study run by Rick Albert, and they showed almost an identical Kaplan-Meier curve and distribution. They did show an interesting effect as well, which was one of the adverse effects, which was a problem on hearing, which indeed none of the other studies have actually shown. So none of the other studies have documented hearing loss as an adverse event. And I'm not sure whether that was a pure chance finding. There have been other studies. There's been a Dutch study, the Columbus trial published in Lancet Respiratory, small study, confirmed the findings. But the study that I found very interesting was the one from a Belgian group that we published in the Blue Journal a few months ago, with an editorial that Fernando Martinez and myself wrote, where the macrolide was started at the time of hospital admission. So these were a selected high-risk patients. And the study suffered from problems with recruitment. It also suffered probably from the composite endpoint, which are tricky in COPD. But they did show up to 6 months, they treated for 6 months, effects on readmissions and mortality. Unfortunately, they then stopped treatment and reduced the power. So this is a treatment that we can also think about to use when somebody comes into hospital having failed maybe triple therapy. James, what about bronchiectasis, which is another very important airway disease?
Yeah, so in bronchiectasis, we aren't blessed with the big randomized controlled trials that you see in asthma and COPD, but there have been three randomized controlled trials of up to 120 patients, and these all show a reduction in exacerbations with the administration of azithromycin in two of the trials and erythromycin in another of the trials. When those were pooled together in an individual patient data meta-analysis that was published in the Lancet Respiratory Medicine in 2019, it's very similar to the asthma story. There's a 50% reduction in exacerbations. Interestingly, there's also a 2.9-point improvement in symptoms. And I don't think we often think about the effect of macrolide on symptoms, but we'll come to that. It's been my experience, some patients have a real transformation in terms of symptoms when they get a macrolide. And that wasn't shown in the individual studies, but when they were pooled together, there was a significant effect on symptoms. So macrolides really work in bronchiectasis. One of the things that I find most puzzling is we then look at registry data, and there's lots of people having 3, 4, 5, 6 exacerbations a year. And macrolides are about the only thing proven to work in bronchiectasis, and they're very rarely used in those patients. Less than 20% of frequent exacerbators get them. So I wonder if there's either a lack of awareness or lots of worries about side effects stopping people using them in bronchiectasis. But they are very effective. In my practice, we use them a lot.
Do you think that might be concerns around overuse of antibiotics, particularly in bronchiectasis where infection's a key driver? Or?
Yeah, I guess the counterpoint to that is most of these people are getting 5 or 6 two-week courses of other broad-spectrum antibiotics. Yeah. So I'm not sure it is the best thing for antibiotic resistance.
Well, no, I agree. And the asthma data suggests that taking azithromycin long-term reduces other antibiotic requirement, but I just want, it'd be interesting to know what the clinician hesitancy was.
Yeah, I think it's the reason for this podcast, isn't it? Not quite knowing where the macrolide or where the antibiotics fit into the treatment paradigm. So for both of you, just this question about symptoms, because we've all said 20 to 50% reduction in exacerbations, regardless of the airways disease. The exacerbation story is very clear. What's the story in symptoms? If you've got a patient with COPD or asthma who's got really severe symptoms, is a macrolide going to make a difference?
Certainly from the literature and the data in asthma, there is an impact on symptoms in some people, just as you mentioned. And it's often that cough and sputum production are probably the key symptoms you might see. And I was actually interested in some of the recent literature in rhinosinusitis using macrolides. I was kind of seeing if there was anything new in asthma, but in fact, this new work in rhinosinusitis, which is suggesting some of those nasal symptoms are reducing. And so I did wonder about that and how it impacts in asthma, COPD, and bronchiectasis, because rhinitis is very common, I think, in all of those conditions. But certainly that cough and sputum production is a key symptom area that we see changes in people.
So, James, in COPD, macrolides have wide actions and they do have effects on mucus production. So, yes, macrolides will reduce sputum production. That is probably how they reduce exacerbations. The problem in the trials is how we measure symptoms in COPD. And we now have the exact RS, which I think is probably the best symptom score. But of course, none of the trials use that score. So we don't have data on symptoms per se. I thought at this stage, maybe we should just say something about macrolides and smoking. Mm. And this is a bit of an issue. So smokers are more likely to have lower airway bacterial colonization. I still think there's an antibacterial effect. There may be effect on mucus. It could be through the bacteria, it could be direct, it could be anti-inflammatory. So I think the mechanism is wide open. So one would expect the smokers almost to benefit more. And certainly patients who have early bronchiectasis and COPD seem to do well in macrolide. Hence, I asked you the question about your views on bronchiectasis. However, in the macro study, what was interesting, the benefit was seen mainly in non-smokers. Again, it was a one-off finding. In our study in erythromycin, whether you are a smoker or non-smoker, the effect was similar. So my concern is that a group may well be denied macrolide treatment and how careful one's got to be with one study. So this has now crept into the gold guidelines. I'm trying to get it changed or putting it in brackets to qualify that it is only one study. But as James said, these are very effective therapies. And there are ways of using them to reduce resistance, such as using them seasonally, as I do. I use them in the UK between the end of September and, let's say, the end of April, and then give patients an off time during the summer, because 70% of exacerbations occur in the summer months.
Yeah. So as you say, GOLD now says don't use azithromycin in smokers. It is based on that analysis of the macro study.
Yes.
What would you say to people who are listening about what to do tomorrow in their clinic if they've got a smoker with frequent exacerbations?
Well, the problem with smokers is that we know that inhaled corticosteroids don't work that well in them. That, I think, there is evidence, good evidence from. It came, you know, if you go right back to Euroscop, that was a problem. If you took the smokers out of Euroscop, you saw an effect on lung function decline. So I think we have a problem, and I certainly, if they are a smoker, I tell them to stop. Obviously, that's the first thing you do, but they'll be on triple therapy and I'll add a macrolide regardless of the evidence in GOLD. I will actually treat them with a macrolide because I think they are, you know, by hunch, they're the group that should do the best with it.
It also speaks to the kind of patients we include in our studies. So you'll never find a smoker in an asthma study. It's not because they don't exist. In fact, a third of, you know, adults with asthma smoke. So we're not studying and getting that information on a real world population. So we need more studies that include everyone.
Yeah. So the smoker issue is difficult, isn't it? Because it's very unlikely anybody's going to do another macro size study in of azithromycin in COPD.
Of course.
So once you have that finding, it's going to be very hard to reverse that unless you were to do a specific trial in smokers.
Yeah.
So there's a research idea for somebody listening, because that is a question that needs answering. Is whether that is a one-off finding or whether that's the truth and it doesn't work in smokers. So let's think a little bit about clinical practice. Let's think a little bit about our patients are coming in, as you said, probably on triple therapy or, you know, on high dose inhaled steroid in asthma, still having exacerbations. We do have other options for reducing exacerbations apart from macrolide. So how do we pick the right patients?
In COPD, I would argue we don't have too many options. That's one of the problems. So let's say you are on triple therapy, or if your eosinophils are very low, again, none of the studies in COPD of macrolides actually stratified by eosinophils, which is actually quite important. And it does look from our data for macro that macrolides do work across the severity of COPD, as Jodie has told us, they work in asthma. So you've got a patient on triple therapy, they've got persistent sputum production and exacerbations. You will do a CT scan and you see some early bronchiectatic, you see some airway thickening. I think that's a very good candidate for long-term macrolide therapy. Again, as I said, whether they're a smoker or not, I would treat smokers in the same way as non-smokers for the purposes of macrolide therapy. The other option we have at the moment is roflumilast, which is used very little at the moment in the UK because of side effects. I must say we did an acute study with it. And even in an acute study, we had a lot of side effects, taking a lot of care not to have side effects. There's also mucolytics you could try, though I think once you're on triple therapy, I think they work early in the disease. If you look at some of the Adostine data I was involved in, it was mild exacerbations, moderate COPD. Once you get to more severe COPD, then I think mucolytics as additive therapy probably have much less effect.
Yeah. And Jodie, for asthma, we have more options. I mean, we have a whole raft now of biologics. How do we decide?
We started to actually measure inflammation, James. We do have some more options. And I guess one thing I just want to quickly add, though, was the idea about smokers and weighing up that benefit and harm. If you've got a patient with COPD who's a smoker who's having severe exacerbations, it may be worth a trial for 3 months to see if there's any benefit. And I think, you know, everyone has to weigh that up individually. But in asthma, we do have some more options now. If you're on high-dose inhaled steroid and lots of bronchodilators and your RT too high, there are certainly those monoclonal options out there now for you. The criteria is quite strict. So I guess macrolides offers something for those who don't meet that criteria. The data is starting to emerge slowly about what exacerbations look like on monoclonals as well. So we know that while they're very effective, they don't take away all of the exacerbations. So there may still be a role for macrolides in some patients. So I think that data is just emerging and it will be interesting to see. We also need to think about access to some of those therapies because they're very expensive. They're not globally available, the monoclonals and things like that. So perhaps macrolides offer something in those areas where access is an issue.
Yeah. So, I mean, let me challenge you on that. So your study showed that eosinophilic patients respond, reduced severe exacerbations requiring steroids.
Yep.
Macrolides are much cheaper than a monoclonal. If you were running a hospital budget or a healthcare system budget, would you say in some of these people try a macrolide before you go to the monoclonal, or are there strong arguments for saying you should?
Well, I have to give full disclosure that I'm not a treating clinician, but if I was running a hospital budget, I would certainly be wanting to think about, is that the step before monoclonals? Would you give that trial for 3 months, as we were talking about, you might do in smokers with COPD, and see if you had that impact? Because, you know, you would be able to know if there's a response in 3 to 6 months. And I guess then you can work someone up for monoclonals without too much time lost. There certainly are those out there who are interested in the combination of monoclonals and macrolides, and perhaps that might be the powerful way to, you know, if you're getting 50% reduction from both, perhaps that's where you get the more bang for your buck. But I do think they are certainly cost effective in reducing hospitalizations and the costs associated with exacerbations.
Okay, so we've said lots of positive things about macrolides and antibiotics. So I think we're going to have to talk a little bit about the adverse effects and the risks for a few minutes. Before we do that, I just want to, we've talked almost exclusively about macrolides because that's where the data is. To both of you, is there a role for non-macrolide oral antibiotics in these diseases?
We have just completed a study of long-term doxycycline, which we have presented and which we are currently sending off for publication. So there is data, but it won't be as stunning as you see with the macrolides, James.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting, suggests maybe the macrolides do have some of these magical immunomodulatory properties. Look forward to seeing that data. Jody?
I guess that's what I was thinking about, those non-antibiotic macrolides. I haven't seen any clinical trials yet, but I've seen some other data which suggests, because we don't know how macrolides work, and we do think that some part of it may be antimicrobial, but there are alternative mechanisms that are reduced. And perhaps if we can harness that, then we actually get the dual benefit of not having to worry about resistance, because we know that we do get induction of resistance genes, but we don't know what that means. But with all the properties of the anti-inflammatory power. So I think that would offer some promise in terms of where people are quite hesitant about using long-term antibiotic therapies.
Yeah, so that's the perfect introduction. The hesitancy is the perfect introduction to a discussion about the adverse effects. I mean, how worried should people be, based on the trials, based on the data, Jody, about the adverse effects of macrolides?
I guess the two key adverse effects certainly that we were concerned about in AMAZEs were hearing loss and QTC. And so what we did is we did screening for that. And so we only treated people who had a QTC, I think, of less than 480. And we did some hearing loss screening. Now, we didn't see any problems with hearing loss when we did that screening before and after in a subgroup. And we didn't treat anyone who had significant hearing impairment either. So I think we were cautious, and I guess using those criteria to give treatment, we can have some certainty about the safety. I guess then that leaves a group of people who don't fit that criteria, and then what to do there.
Yeah.
But the hearing loss, I think, is not something we saw in any patient. I think we had one patient in AMAZEs who reported significant hearing loss, and when we unblinded them, they were on placebo. So we didn't see a signal in asthma.
So my reading of this, I think there probably is a hearing loss issue with very high doses of azithromycin. And the macro study, which is the one study that saw it, used 250 milligrams daily.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure azithromycin is a daily drug. I certainly use it Monday, Wednesday, Friday. 250 daily is a big dose. And I wonder if that's the reason why they saw that issue, because all the other trials have used lower doses. Does that sound plausible?
If you go through all the studies, hearing loss wasn't a problem. It wasn't a problem with erythromycin in our study. They did use double the dose that everyone else would use for a year. And I think it was probably a one-off thing, as you say, with the higher dose. I think QT intervals you do have to be careful with, and the ECG should be checked before starting therapy. And if there are issues with QT intervals, then I would not use a macrolide. I'd probably try and use low-dose roflumilast or whatever carefully. As for resistance, well, this is a problem because we know in COPD very little about antibiotic resistance. That's the problem. And what impact this has on resistance, you know, we're told that we're going to affect resistance in the community. But I really think we have very little information on this at the moment, James, and that is the problem. So in order to try and reduce resistance, that's why I use macrolide seasonally and give patients time off in the late spring and summer.
So let's talk about resistance. So most of the trials, if they look, will show macrolide resistant organisms in the nasopharynx or in the airways. Do we know what that means, Jody?
I don't think so. And I think so we look for it and it's there, but we don't know what that means clinically. We don't know if that has an impact on your future ability to respond to various antibiotics. And I think certainly we need to understand that more. But again, you know, will the studies happen now that it's widely used in clinical practice? And I'm not sure if there's an appetite to know.
Yeah, I mean, you almost, now that we've been using these for a long time, almost want to see data on people who've been on macrolide for sort of 10 years and, you know, have they had macrolide resistant infections or?
We don't know the right dose, the dose duration. Certainly there is, I think, quite a lot of clinicians doing kind of those, you know, dose holidays during the summer. So there's a lot still to learn about the best ways to use macrolides in airways disease. Yeah.
What do you think should be the optimal dose? Let's nail that one down, because everybody I talk to uses something slightly
different.
Everyone's
got a favorite.
So we talked about macro and 250 daily, but there's some studies used 250 three times a week, some used 500 three times a week, others used other combination of doses. I mean, what should people be doing?
Well, macrolides are very well concentrated in the lungs, so I don't think you need to use a lot. So I used azithromycin, 250 milligrams three times a week. Of course, if azithromycin gives you side effect nausea, vomiting, you do have other macrolides to try. We used erythromycin, again, low dose with hardly any side effects, and people continued for the year. We didn't give them a holiday in the trial. We did a year of it. So I think there are options with macrolides. If you get, obviously, QT side effects, you can't use macrolides, but other side effects, you could try another macrolide. And I think we will see in the future non-antibiotic macrolides. I think, James, one thing that convinced me that there was an anti-inflammatory reaction, I always thought macrolides were acting as antibacterials, was really the effect in asthma. I know in asthma, you also get bacterial colonization, but you get much lower levels of it. And I think that convinced me, you know, if you're getting 50% reduction of exacerbations, this must be an anti-inflammatory effect. So I think we will see non-antibiotic macrolides, and that's going to be very interesting to study, to see exactly whether the effects are similar, better, or whatever.
Yeah. So personally, I agree with you on the dose. So the 250 three times a week is also what I use. And my rationale for that is the two trials that saw the most side effects were the Albert study that you talked about, which was 250 daily, and a bronchiectasis study called the BAT trial that was 250 daily, where there was a lot of gastrointestinal side effects, which weren't seen in other trials that used smaller doses. So I think the efficacy of macrolide is not clearly dose related. Low doses still seem to be effective, but the side effects do seem to be dose related. So I tend to start with the lower dose and see where that takes me. Anything further on dose, Jody?
Well, I would think that makes sense in terms of how we apply other therapies in asthma. We start with lowest dose and go from there. And certainly, you know, 250 three times a week, there's evidence that that's effective in patients with airways disease. So trying that out first. And what we don't know is if can we go for a lower dose? Can we dose twice a week? So I guess there's all of that too.
Yeah, as Vizier alluded to, that it gets so well concentrated in phagocytes in the lung, it probably weeks before you clear your azithromycin. So maybe weekly dosing would work.
I mean, we don't know, but if one of the anti-inflammatory mechanisms is actually improving phagocyte function, then, you know, you may be able to reduce the frequency or reduce the dose and get the same outcome clinically.
Yeah, we're giving listeners loads of great research ideas today. So before we finish, I want to touch on this thorny issue of how they work. And we've kind of been talking about it as we've gone through, but do you have a strong feeling as to what the mechanism of action is for most of these patients in terms of reducing exacerbations?
I certainly think there is an anti-mucus, anti-sputum effect of macrolides, because patients do, we talked at the beginning about symptoms, and patients do report reduction in sputum production. That is something clinically that you see. I think there must be an antibacterial effect. These are, of course, antibiotics. And I think there is an effect on certainly macrolides increase interferon production. So there are potentially antiviral effects here as well, which may contribute to the effects on exacerbations and, of course, anti-inflammatory effects. So we have a number of mechanisms, which I think, James, will be very difficult to disentangle. That's the problem.
Yeah. So I was a real fan of the idea that this was somehow antiviral, because when you look at CF, bronchiectasis, COPD, asthma, the inflammatory pathways are so different. But the one thing that's common between them is that viruses stir things up and cause exacerbations. So I thought, you know, logically, it makes sense that macrolides must be doing something in the context of viral infections. And then the COVID data is as negative as it could possibly be. Should I be dissuaded, or is it just COVID's a completely different animal?
I must say, if I got COVID again, I might well start myself immediately on a macrolide. I indeed wrote a grant which wasn't successful on this, so suggesting that early treatment. I think if you're going to use macrolides in COVID or in any acute viral infection, you've got to start the macrolide at the very, very early onset of the viral infection. That's the problem, because that's when the interferon levels go up almost as you're getting the first symptoms. So I would say they were used too late. I tried to write a grant on using macrolides early in COVID, and the government wasn't interested. So what do I do about it? But I'm not sure that they don't work in COVID.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, isn't it? Our airways disease patients are loaded with macrolide at the point they're exposed to the virus, which is very different to starting it in an established viral infection. Yes. So I think that's a very good point.
And I think some of the story about protection may have been due to the fact that these people, not so much on the ICS, I think there's evidence in COPD that ICS don't protect, but certainly macrolides may protect you against COVID. So I wouldn't write off, James, macrolides in COVID and other viral infections. Why should COVID be so different in the early stages from rhinovirus? In the early stages, it causes a cold, an upper respiratory infection. That's what I had. And then it causes lower airway symptoms. Then it causes other things. So I think in the early stages, if you can get it in early enough, it may well work, but it may pay patients on macrolides. That's something that could be looked at actually in a database, is where people on macrolides less likely to get COVID. That I think certainly could be done.
So that's a really interesting question from a research perspective. As a reminder, our ERS guidelines say don't use macrolides in COVID.
Do they? Jody, okay.
Jody, in the AMAZES study, some of your data showed big changes in Haemophilus in the asthma patients. So could it all just be an antibacterial effect?
Well, no, I don't think it is all just an antibacterial effect. And I'll tell you why. Because in the AMAZES data, we've been trying to unpick this over a number of years. So we do know there is a reduction in Haemophilus, but we also know a number of other things. We have a reduction in those pro-inflammatory cytokines in the sputum, and we have a reduction, James, in some of the NETs and their products, so the neutrophil extracellular traps. And so that, I think there's lots of things going on there. And so that reduction we might see in sputum production could be associated with that reduction in NETs and improving clearance. But also, it's not as simple as just wiping out the bacteria, because the macrolides didn't wipe out all of the bacteria. There seemed to be a Haemophilus-specific effect, certainly in the MESA study. I don't know yet, and I don't think at this point we can say it's an antibiotic-only impact. So we're just reducing all bacteria and therefore the inflammation goes away. It seemed to be targeted around that Haemophilus. And there certainly seems to be a group of patients in asthma as well as in COPD from the recent cluster analysis that I've seen from Chris Breitling's group showing that there is this Haemophilus high, IL-1 beta high group of patients. And I guess perhaps if we were going to get into targeting a group outside clinical symptoms, that may be a group worthwhile exploring for targeting with macrolide therapy, because they seem to be the markers and the mechanisms that are responding. And I guess that might work out in bronchiectasis, but I don't know if it's been looked at.
Yeah, it has this wonderful sort of cross airways disease treatable traits idea, isn't there? That there is definitely a group of patients that looks very similar regardless of what the disease label is.
Yeah.
We're coming towards the end now. So I thought it would be good to just ask both of you for your takeaway tips for those listening. You know, what do you want people to take away as the key messages from a long-term antibiotic perspective?
So my take-home message is that long-term macrolide therapy is feasible. We have guidelines on how it should be used in patients as add-on therapy, usually after triple or in low eosinophil groups after dual bronchodilators, and it will have an effect on exacerbation frequency and improve quality of life. And we must be prepared to use it.
Fantastic. And Jody?
Yeah, I think I would echo that and say you know, there's good evidence that macrolides are safe and effective. They're also a cost-effective alternative to high-dose oral steroids and other things that might be added in more severe disease and to our monoclonals now in asthma. But I wouldn't be able to finish without saying, but if you can measure the inflammation, because you may be able to, you know, really pinpoint the group of patients you'd like to give it to.
Yeah, fantastic. And so from a bronchiectasis perspective, I would say obviously the backbone of our treatment is airway clearance. But if you've got patients who you've identified the underlying cause and you've treated it, you've got them doing good airway clearance and they're still having exacerbations, macrolides are a fantastic option that will cut exacerbations by 50% and also improve quality of life. So they're a great tool in our arsenal. Thanks for joining us for this ERS podcast. I'm sure you'll agree it's been a fantastic discussion with lots of messages that are useful for our clinical practice. A big thank you to Jodie and to Vizia for their contributions and their insights into this topic. And I hope it's been useful for all of our listeners. You can visit the ERS Respiratory Channel each month for more podcasts featuring discussion between experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine. For now, thanks for joining us and see you again soon.
Thank you so much, both of you. That was terrific. Really great discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, James.
My cats are hissing in the back. They've all had a fight while we've been doing that.